The World's Fair vision of the future was fanciful and more like science fiction than any possible reality. But nowadays, machines are set to take over significant portions of our day-to-day lives. Google and car makers are pressing ahead with automated driving. Digital map services automatically calculate the fastest routes, even including traffic. Search engines do in seconds what required hours in libraries, and autopilots have actually been flying airplanes for decades. But could we be losing something through the wonders of automation? Nicholas Carr explores this question in his newest book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. It's out from Norton, and I'm very pleased it has brought Mr. Carr back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
You quote a Harvard business professor from 1958 arguing that the word automation was being thrown around too easily. Do we need to specify what we mean by that word?
Well, I think we do, and I use a broad definition. We used to think, when people think about automation, they still think, I think, about factories and machines and robots. But
so that's mechanization?
That's what we used to call mechanization. Then after the computer came along, after the Second World War, we began referring to it as automation. And now I think I take a broader definition because computers are automating so many aspects of our lives that it's when we look to technology, and computers in particular, to do things we used to do ourselves or to do things on behalf of us.
You're right about a very specific kind of automation that's now common, the glass cockpit. What's that?
That's aviation automation. And so back in the early 1980s, computers began to be introduced into airline flight, and pilots began to refer to the cockpit as the glass cockpit, and they were referring to all the computer monitors that increasingly were wrapped around them. And now if you look into an airline or a cockpit, it's like a flying computer, as one expert said. And that's really changed the nature of flight. And up until recently, it was a very positive story. It made flight much safer, more efficient. But we've been seeing signs in the last few years that we may have gone too far.
Are you referring to the case of the Buffalo air crash of February 2009?
There was the Buffalo crash, and then shortly after that, the even bigger Air France crash, a flight out of Brazil. And in both cases, what happened is that the pilots, the autopilot system shut off in the middle of the flight or toward the end of the flight in Buffalo, and the pilots did the wrong thing. They reacted poorly, and what it seemed to show is that when you become too dependent on a computer or an autopilot system, in this case, you lose situational awareness. You tune out, and then when there's an emergency happens, you do the wrong thing.
Well, those were relatively inexperienced pilots. What about experienced pilots? Do they feel dissatisfaction? Although they can take over, can't they, if they wish?
They can. And one of the things that the aviation experience tells us is that we're very quick to hand over things to computers or other machines, even when if we kind of took back control frequently, we'd actually perform better, learn more. But we've come to the point where the FAA last year kind of sent out an alert to airlines saying, you know, you really should encourage pilots to take manual control more often, because we're seeing this erosion of skill and this lack of awareness, and it's becoming a problem.
The NTSB has found that glass cockpits had a lower overall accident rate but a higher chance of being involved in a fatal accident. Does that suggest that when an error happens, pilots are less ready to respond or less capable of responding?
I think so. And I mean, the good news is that these are very rare situations, but they do happen. In the Air France crash, for instance, the sensors on the plane that sense the airspeed got covered with ice, and so airspeed data didn't come to the computer. The computer shut down because it didn't have the data. And so, you know, suddenly the pilot had to take over manual control, and it wasn't an emergency until the pilot did the wrong thing, kind of did something that a lot of pilots look back on and can't quite figure out.
Well, with a highly experienced pilot, is there a kind of a shock or confusion when the computer or autopilot doesn't perform well?
Yes, and that's exactly what the NTSB and other investigators have found, is that there's this period of disorientation. And we see it not only in pilots, but everyone who becomes kind of dependent on the computer to take over. We very quickly lose awareness and lose get out of touch with our situation.
And then we wind up with heroes like Scully, who
right.
Took over and landed his plane in the middle of the East River.
Which actually happened about a month before the crash in Buffalo. And, you know, one reaction to all of this is people say, well, let's get rid of the pilot altogether and just make it completely automated. But the Sullenberger incident where the plane hits Canada Geese, all the engines go out, and suddenly he has 3 minutes to land the plane on water, show that we can't get rid of the human being. We have to work in tandem with, in concert with computers, and we should do it well.
My guest is Nicholas Carr. His latest book, The Glass Cage, Automation and Us, it's published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Do we assume that once things are automated, systems are fail-safe? Because in the movies, whenever that happens, you know things are going to go wrong.
We do. And researchers, scholars of automation refer to it as automation complacency. And what it simply means is even though rationally we know that there's no fail-safe system available, that every technology is going to break down sooner or later, we become lulled into a false sense of security because actually the systems, the computers, are very good. But that kind of ironically makes the problem worse because when failures become rare, that's when we become most kind of cut off from our awareness of our surroundings, and that's when trouble happens.
So why do sci-fi writers and screenwriters get it right while economists and engineers sometimes get it wrong?
I think engineers in particular have a bias toward what's called technology-centered automation. A lot of programmers, a lot of engineers, they see human beings as kind of the flaw in the system. We're unpredictable, we're imprecise, sometimes unreliable, and so the instinct is, well, let's let the computer do everything possible, and then whatever's left over we'll give to the human being. Unfortunately, that puts the person into the position of an observer, a kind of last line of defense, things that we're actually not good at.
What happens when you have automated systems on top of other automated systems? Can you have a major cascading failure?
Yeah, we tend to think of, you know, computers as precise and kind of never making mistakes, but increasingly technology in our world is composed of many different systems connected to each other, and a very small flaw, a very small failure in one component or bad line of software can set off what engineers talk about as cascading failures. And it's at that point when you really want people to have expertise, to be aware of the situation so they can take over quickly.
Isn't the design and testing of aircraft or other means of transport also being automated with old methods of physical testing being replaced with digital tests?
Well, increasingly in aviation and in other places, we're seeing the simulation training taking place in computer simulations. And that can be very good. I mean, it provides a much more efficient way to give a realistic sense of where you are. But again, it kind of puts us all the more into the mesh of this, the kind of abstract world that doesn't necessarily totally substitute for the real physical world.
Well, wasn't the Boeing 787 Dreamliner fast-tracked to production by undergoing digital testing instead of the traditional flight testing of prototypes?
I am not an expert on how that came about, but I imagine it was, and you know, it may well have sped up some parts of that kind of process.
We're seeing lots of things being tested digitally, chemical products. Partly in an attempt to mollify animal rights groups, but also your automobile checkups are now relying on computer analysis. How accurate are they?
I think in general, in those situations, they're quite accurate, and it's kind of an example of how, and this isn't necessarily a bad thing, but when we become very dependent on computers and design things around them, then we begin to cut the human being out of the process, and you can only deal with these things in a kind of digital fashion.
On the other hand, the human beings who are now being asked to participate in this situation have grown up, most of them, with computers. They are much more amenable to relying on them than old-timers.
But the effects, I think, both good and bad, are the same regardless of whether you're used to the computer or not. And in some ways, being more adapted to the computer actually can add to the problem, this problem of complacency, another problem called automation bias, where you put too much faith into what's coming through your computer screen. There is a famous accident with a cruise liner where the GPS system got unplugged, and everybody on the deck, everybody on the bridge, just assumed that the computer was keeping them on track. And there was even a first mate whose job was to watch for a buoy, a locational buoy, who didn't see it but didn't bother to report it because he assumed that he failed in seeing it, because how could the computer put them off course? And the ocean liner ended up crashing into a sandbar. So we kind of our faith in computers sometimes ends up blinding us to what we should really be seeing.
Just 10 or 15 years ago, weren't engineers insisting that robotically driven cars would be impossible because of things like left-hand turns? Now we have estimates of a glass cockpit in our cars being quite soon.
And you could even argue that we already have a sort of glass cockpit, at least in some higher-end vehicles that has adaptive cruise control, so it uses radar to keep you at a certain distance from cars in front of you. It senses where you are in the lane and keeps you centered. So we're already...
They park your car for you.
They'll parallel park. You know, we're already kind of seeing the computer take over a lot of aspects of driving. And my own feeling is that actually it's going to be very difficult to get fully automated robotic cars out on the highway. Even Google's car, which is a magnificent engineering achievement, you know, can't really drive in cities. It can't drive in places that haven't been carefully mapped. So getting from semi-automation to total automation can often be a very, very difficult challenge.
I spoke to someone from Google just yesterday, and I asked him, what happens when your car is driving down the street looking for a parking spot, and suddenly you see one on the right side? Does the car immediately know what to do? And he didn't answer me.
Google hasn't divulged all of the shortcomings of its technology, but it's clear that in some cases, take the everyday example of a person who's driving their car and using, say, Google Maps to get from one place to another. Often that makes things easier, it makes things simpler, but when you get off track, and this happens quite a bit, suddenly you have to fiddle with your smartphone while you're also driving, and that's an example of how automation, which is intended to relieve you of work and make you safer, actually at the worst possible moment can require you to juggle more tasks.
And I've had the experience of a Garmin telling me to make a left turn onto a road when there was no left turn. The road was actually below the bridge that I was on. I would have had to have done something out of an old movie where we went flying off the bridge to get onto that other street. They don't know everything. Apple just released its iPhone 6, and within hours, there was a flood of complaints. What would happen if just 1,000 New Jersey drivers got out on New York City streets with autonomous cars?
You'd see...
Forgive me, New Jersey. When New York drivers were on the Garden State...
What we know is that, as you said earlier, there is no foolproof technology. And the danger we're in is that we're not being called upon. When we rely on automation, we're not being called on to practice our skills, to develop our skills. And then because we're the last line of defense, when something goes wrong and we suddenly have to take over, we find that we've lost those skills. We've lost our awareness, and we make mistakes, make bad judgment. And people, I think people who depend on GPS, who depend on other apps to do day-to-day things, are aware of this, because all of these things will make mistakes. And if you're not talented, if you've if you're not aware of what's going on, you will compound the mistakes with your own actions.
Nicholas Carr is the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Shallows. He, and among other books, he's written for most of the regular journals and also writes the widely read blog Rough Type. His latest book is The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. It's published by Norton. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Nicholas Carr, whose latest book is The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. It's published by Norton. We've been getting questions from our listeners. Are we already seeing a computerized parallel to the fuel hybrid with an increase in computer components that take on more and more tasks for us?
Absolutely. If you look at cars today, we have the technology to do most of the driving in most situations, at least when you're out on the highway, taking over brakes and steering and acceleration. One thing that's kind of scary is that pilots at least have to go through rigorous training in how to use automation, because it is a tricky handoff between the human being and in the automated system. In cars today, we get all this automation and we kind of drive off the dealer's lot without any training. And if you talk to experts in automation, they'll tell you that is about the worst way to go about making this transition, as you can imagine.
You cite several historical figures, Alfred North Whitehead, John Maynard Keynes, Karl Marx, who all believed that automation would free us from drudgery. Was that true at one time?
I think it was generally true. So if, as factory work, craftsmanship became automated, if you were a craftsman, it didn't free you to better work. It put you out of a job or put you into, turned you into a machine operator, which was much less interesting than being a craftsman. But I think it, through the increase in productivity, it ended up creating lots more jobs that were quite sophisticated.
Automation in the workplace is supposed to make our lives easier, give us more leisure time. But aren't Americans working longer hours? That is, if they have jobs at all.
We are. And obviously one reason for that is that when you're connected to your job with a computer, as most people are today with smartphones or whatever, it's very hard to break away. We used to have, a moment when you stepped away from out of the office, stepped away from the factory or whatever and went home, and you were there was a clean break with the workday, and thanks or no thanks to technology, that clean break has pretty much disappeared.
Well, how is this related to what's called the substitution myth?
When designers create automated systems, they believe that they can substitute a computer or a machine for a human being in doing some task, but that substitution won't change the task itself. It won't change how people remaining work. It won't change the nature of the job. And in fact, what we found through research is that the substitution myth is in fact a myth, that when you hand over some aspect of work to a computer, you change the fundamental nature of the work. And we're seeing this, for example, in the computerization of medicine. The way doctors relate to patients, the way doctors relate to each other, changes in a pretty dramatic fashion when you introduce, for instance, digital record keeping in place of dictation or handwritten records.
Some people will see what you're writing here as the typical resistance we've seen throughout history. I imagine people were freaked out when the wheel was invented. I know that when Gutenberg started printing books, people were outraged and thought that would be the end of civilization. I remember when simple things like slide rules were replaced by little calculators. Now nobody even knows how to use a slide rule. And there were complaints at that time that it would affect the way our brains worked. How is this any different?
Well, I think in going from essentially mechanical automation to digital, computerized automation, we changed the nature of automation itself. So it used to be automation automated production processes. Now more and more what we're automating experience, the experience of life, whether it's a sophisticated professional, a doctor or a lawyer or an architect working more and more through computers, or whether it's us in our day-to-day life using Facebook to automate social processes or using Google Maps to automate navigation, we're automating things like analysis, judgment, decision-making that are very much core, very much essential to the quality of our life and in the essence of the development of ourself.
But we're also automating things that we dislike or find repetitive or dull. You cite the work of a psychologist whose name I will almost be guaranteed to mispronounce, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who's written about what he calls flow.
Yeah.
How close did I come?
Csikszentmihalyi, I think, mm-hmm. And I might have gotten that wrong anyway. But one thing he's found is that there's a psychological distortion in our thinking that psychologists refer to as miswanting, that we think we want to be relieved of effort and labor and hard work. But in fact, when you look at what makes us happy and feel fulfilled and feel satisfied, it's when we're struggling with something hard, when we're lost in the work, which is what he refers to as flow. And that explains why we're so quick to just want to hand stuff off to computers. But what we find often is that by taking away hard work, taking away the type of work that engages us, builds our skills, we're actually removing what gives us pleasure. We're kind of freeing ourselves from what makes us feel free.
But when Henry Ford introduced his production lines, he had problems retaining employees. The work was just too repetitive. And now robots do that. They never get bored.
And that's one of their great strengths. And it's not that automation is bad. It's that we have to think very carefully about how we go about automating things. For instance, you can automation works best when it automates skills that we've already mastered. So to go back to your example of the slide rule, if you have a calculator, if you've mastered basic arithmetic, some basic math, and then you use the calculator to automate that, then that frees you to go to a higher level of thinking in mathematics. But if you use the calculator simply to replace your skill-building exercise, to take over the math and arithmetic before you've mastered it, then that cuts you off from higher levels of mathematics, higher levels of thinking.
A listener, Ellen, has called in with this question. She's concerned about the lack of human contact in some of these cases. She asks how you would deal with a doctor in an office who is dictating information about her into a computer. Would you ask the doctor to stop and speak to her directly?
If necessary, yes. I mean, what we found is when you introduce computers into examination rooms, doctors spend about 25% to 50% of the visit looking at their computer screen. And doctors in general are not happy about that. Patients aren't happy about that. But if you demand, as many hospitals do, if you demand that record keeping be digitized, then basically you're forcing the doctor into that role.
On the other hand, if you come in with some problem and a doctor goes to his or her laptop and comes up with something that he's never seen this before, but there it is, aren't you grateful for that? The alternative is for him to consult, to look into 20 books. It could take a long time.
Right. And when we move toward the kind of automation of analytical and judgment-making skills, where the computer can be really helpful is to bring information to us that we might not have thought of, or to challenge us with different interpretations. And if we can do that, allow space for the doctor or whatever professional to do their job, but then use the computer to kind of enrich their thinking, that's a good way to automate these kind of tasks.
You quote economic historian Robert Skidelsky, who says that sooner or later we will run out of jobs. Isn't Skidelsky asking a largely economic question about how people can earn a living when machines can do most of what people used to do?
Yes, and in what we've been talking about is how automation changes the work we do. There's obviously a whole other question about, is it going to relieve us of jobs entirely? And that's a big controversy in economics today, and we're unsure how it will play out. But an interesting and kind of concerning trend is that, unlike mechanical automation that took some jobs but created a lot more, the history of computers so far over the last few decades shows that computers are very good at taking over jobs, but we're not seeing the huge, big new categories of middle-class jobs being created that we need to sustain the middle class.
We have associated automation largely with blue-collar jobs, but it's making its way into white-collar workplaces. They had been considered safe until fairly recently.
When you look at how quickly computers have been programmed to sense the environment, to take in information, to analyze the information, and then to come up with a judgment, you realize that there are lots of professional work, lots of white-collar work that are at risk. And a great example is in lawyers' offices, where the task of evidence discovery, which used to take lots of junior lawyers, lots of paralegals, has been basically entirely turned over to computers that can essentially read huge amounts of text and discern sophisticated things like relationships between people, people's emotions. And so that's a good example of how a big class of good jobs can be taken over quite quickly by computers.
Several Time reporters had exchanges with a robot about health insurance last December. The robot sounded so human that it took several calls to confirm that it was really a robot and not a human.
We're easily fooled because we're such social animals that we want to attribute human characteristics to even inanimate objects, and certainly if you get a computer programmed to hold a conversation with you, your instinct is to want to believe that that computer is a person.
An LA Times reviewer called you one of the information age's chief scaredy cats. Do you think of yourself as a Luddite?
I don't. In some ways, this book is a celebration of technology and of computers, and it's not a plea to go backwards. What it is a I'm recognizing that we're at the cusp of a new era when more and more of our lives are going to be automated. More and more of our everyday interactions are going to go through computers. And to move forward in a smart way, we have to be very careful and very wise about how we program these things and design these things so that we keep to ourselves the aspects of life that give it meaning, that allow us to be satisfied and happy, and not just rush to give everything over to computers, thinking that we'll come out at the end as some better species.
Over the years, a wide range of thinkers, Ricardo, Marx, Keynes, Galbraith, more recently Krugman, Piketty, Ha-Jun Chang, Stanley Aronowitz, Jeremy Rifkin, Robert Skidelsky, have all been dismissed by the mainstream. Because they are seen as, I guess, as also scaredy cats. Do you think that we may finally be seeing a reassessment of how we think about these problems?
I think we are seeing a reassessment. The old assumption that we could rely on labor-saving technology to expand the middle class, to expand the pool of good jobs, high-paying jobs, that is really in doubt right now. And as I say, it's going to be a while before we see which way it goes, but we better start preparing for the possibility that we're going to see a continued erosion of the middle class.
So we should not be blaming the people in the White House for the fact that even though we're going through an economic expansion, the quality of the jobs and the pay for the jobs since the crash of 2008 has not improved. If anything, it's gone down.
It certainly can't all be narrowed down to the question of technology. There's all sorts of policy questions, international trade questions. But I do think it's becoming clearer and clearer that the expansion of automation throughout the economy is having a fairly dramatic effect and will continue to have a fairly dramatic effect on not only the number of jobs created, but the type of jobs that are being created.
Because the jobs that in the past required skilled humans are now being taken over by skilled machines.
Even the jobs that required skilled analysis, skilled decision-making, management jobs, lawyer, you know, legal jobs, doctor's jobs,
program even those. Program directors, we hope?
We'll see.
Nicholas Carr will be – I hope my boss wasn't listening. Nicholas Carr will be speaking at the 92nd Street Y tonight at 8:15. For ticket information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. And the book that we have been discussing is The Glass Cage, Automation and Us. It is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show, and you don't look like a scaredy cat to me.
Well, thank you, Leonard. I don't feel like one either.